Hello, this is Alex again, introducing the final interview episode for season three. It's been rather drawn out over these summer months, so thank you for your patience. There's been one or two reasons for that, but the main one is I've been getting over some long-ish COVID issues, but I've been making a bit of progress on that, and in a couple of weeks' time, I'll set out a bit more about the future of this podcast, but the good news is there is a future, so there is. What I wanted to do right now, though, of course, is introduce today's guest, Professor Michael Broers. He's Professor of Western European History at Lady Margaret Hall, and listeners to the podcast will have heard him talking about the preliminaries of Lioben and then the Treaty of Campo Formio. Now, he is a tremendous person to speak to, full of wit and charm, and that really shines through in the interview you're about to hear. Of course, Professor Broers' big interests are in Italian and French history in the 18th and 19th centuries, but I guess naturally a lot of our time focused on somebody called Napoleon, not least because Michael's just finished writing the third volume of his magnificent trilogy, a biography of Napoleon Bonaparte. The first book, Napoleon, Soldier of Destiny, was published in 2014. Then Napoleon, The Spirit of the Age, 1805 to 1810, was published in 2018. And just published very recently the concluding volume, Napoleon, The Decline and Fall of an Empire, 1811 to 1821. And that was published recently. Now, when I spoke to Michael, I think it was actually late last year. So he just finished writing it, but I don't think he'd fully processed that he'd finished it. And that comes across here. Now, apologies for the audio quality, which is probably amongst the worst we've had. I hope it'll be bearable. I've spent some time trying to clean it all up, which has been a little bit painstaking. So hopefully it's listenable too. I began by asking him how he felt about finishing this massive project of his. And I think because it had been finished so recently, that definitely came across in his answer. Hope you enjoy the interview.
A bit confusing is how I would put it. Producing a book is a funny thing, in that because it's not done yet. It's not been published, it's not been reviewed, it's not been held up for ridicule or praise, or worse, the ignominy of saying, you know, well, yes, that's all right. But it's confusion in a way, because it's come together with so many other things. It's come together with the end of the CUP project, which I've been co-editing with Philip Dwyer, my great pal and rival. That was a big project. It's come at the end of that. It's come at the end of my formal working life, because I retire in October. I don't want to, but 68, you go. And so it's a funny old time, actually, to be thinking about what's next and what's past. Because the book isn't quite, in that sense, it's not published, it's not out there yet. So you don't know. And of course, what you go through in a production of a book, as you know, everybody you have on your podcast knows, is that I've been through the boring bits. You know, I've been through the copy editing, I've been through the proofs. I expect I haven't done them very well, you know, which I never do, and I've put hands up to that. I'm only now getting into the fun bit, the publicity and that kind of thing. So you're in that kind of limbo, the phrase, I don't ever want to see it again. You know, I don't ever want to open it. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to know. I'm afraid to open it because I think, oh, you missed that. Well, that name's misspelled. But quite seriously, when you do look back over it, there are certain things I've tried to do that I hope have come off that... One of the beefs I have about a lot of Napoleonic biographies is that people are too cavalier with their use of sources.
What do you mean by that?
There is an awful lot of, particularly memoirs out there about Napoleon, and a lot of them are great reads, and they should be, because most of them were ghosted by Balzac. Now, I worked as a very young man, a very, very young scholar, I worked with Jean Chouinard's team sourcing some of these things. It's, you know, amazing how many really things that people cite all the time. You know, they were ghosted by Balzac, and if you think about it, a lot of these guys were semi-literate. And Balzac tells a good tale. Or somebody would just sell their name to a publisher because after 1814, everybody needed money. And they're great stories, but their provenance is dubious. The person who purports to be telling you was hundreds of miles away at the time. And it wasn't written by him. I mean, at least say when Harry Caine writes his column, The Sun has the decency to say Harry Caine was talking too.
It's nice work if you can get it.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it must have been.
For Balzac as well.
So, you know, what I've tried to do, where I think that these correspondence has been wonderful, is to get away from that. Because going through that correspondence as I've had to do it, yes, there are the great set-piece letters. There they are, great set-piece things. But most of it is like reading somebody's texts. It's like reading somebody's essay. Now, you cannot hide behind the daily correspondence and the devil is in the details. No, he didn't have a plan B. You know, yes, he did have a plan B, but he wasn't telling him. You know, or he flies off the handle and then he has to apologize. I find that very important and very interesting. You find a development of a mind under pressure. But the other thing is to evaluate the really good memoirs we have, to sift them out and say, no, look, these are the ones that can tell you. And a lot of things, new things that have come to light, like the Cambertin, who's the second most important person in the world for a lot of this time. Marvelous biography done a few years ago by Laurence Châtel du Briançon, that you got access to Cambertin's private notes. They weren't just exactly a diary, and they weren't memoirs. They were private notes that he would write up as soon as he could about his conversations with everybody, Napoleon included, mainly. Because being a lawyer, he said you could never publish them. So she could read them, but not quote directly from them, unless it was talking to somebody other than Napoleon. He was very loyal. But now we have that biography, we have access to those papers. You know, it's helped so much, so many other things. You know, Colin Crewe's memoirs, again, properly edited. New stuff found. Wolfram Seemann's Life of Metternich, incredibly important.
Ah, I'm so, yeah, I'm a big fan of that book. I that's my top pick. Well, I mean, how would you describe your approach compared to Wolfram Seemann's? I mean, you know, is that a comparison to make?
Well, look, I mean, he's a great man, and I would shudder to make a comparison in quality, but I think we share similar values as in the story. We all knew Metternich's memoirs were dodgy, but now we know precisely how, because the actual correspondence gives you a different story, as indeed does Napoleon's, about him. It can give you a different narrative, you know, and it shows you how the mind is working at the time, which, look, I'm a brass tacks historian, and how the mind is working at the time is important to me. That was the pressure, that was the atmosphere, that was the mindset under which those decisions were made, and that's where I think Seemann is irreplaceable.
Yeah, and that clearly shines through in your work as well, because that is what it's all about. It's about the mindset of the individual as they, you know, they're going through their life supported by those around them, but under pressure, what is in their heads? And that, I suppose, really, that's the art of the historian, isn't it, to try and get into these people's heads, and that's what you're trying to do with Bonaparte. And the question has to be, what surprised you most? And was there a particular period when the gap between the myth and the legend and the reality of that mindset, was at its greatest?
That's a good one. I don't think things move in straight lines. They ebb and flow with a person. I think there is a bit, probably, I think the conversations with Colin Crewe on his way back from Russia are probably of more use in some ways than the memoirs from St. Helena, because he's thinking on his feet. It shows how, not willfully, but how detached he's become from French realities. And he can, in a brass tacks way, get back to those realities by snapping his fingers and snapping the gear. But the climate of France, how to judge the mood of France, is gone from then on, I think. He's under too much pressure to think about it, to be fair to him. But that's when the gap between, you know, between the reality of that is most apparent, because it's the fatal one. But it's, you can see, one of the things I found that really surprised me, and it would, is the new discoveries that were made about one particularly important document that was found buried in the Pierpont Library in New York. It was in 1805. The doubts he has about the Austerlitz campaign, the real worry, that he fires off to Talleyrand, that look, that he does not put Louis in his King of Holland out of hubris. He's already saying, look, we cannot depend on the direct, we cannot depend on the Batavian Commonwealth leadership. They've all got accounts at Lloyd's of London. I am leaving the Channel Coast undefended. There is nothing but some National Guards between the Royal Marines and you. This is brinkmanship, but there's nothing else I can do. This isn't an overconfident, hubristic guy. I mean, I'm not saying you don't see that, Napoleon. You do. But not when you think you do sometimes. It's like, this is going to be a near-run thing and we could lose everything. I think the other time you see him at his most vulnerable, and this is where I think you see an important shift in his mentality. I'm not saying something hits him out of the blue. Nothing hits him out of the blue. It's always been there. You know, there's always been something in his mind that thinks this way. But this is when it comes to the fore, and when it doesn't go away, is after Wagram.
Ah.
He suffered tremendous personal loss at Wagram through Lannes, you know, at Aspernessing, one thing and another. But an awful lot of other people close to him killed. He's coming back to Paris after Schönbrunn, and he's thinking on the, he's thinking about two things. On the one hand is, where were my brothers? Where were the people I helped? They're complaining. They wouldn't be on their thrones if it hadn't been for my army and their sacrifices. And not just a French army, it was an Italian army too. You know, Eugene and I did this. No one's grateful to us. All they do is complain. You know, what kind of people am I dealing with? And from my own point of view, my own work, which tends to be more about, you know, the administration of the empire, that kind of thing, it's going to have to change. We're going to have to move away from this satellite kingdom model towards a much more integrated Roman-style uniform French model, because I can't trust them in bitterness. And the other thing where you find him at his most vulnerable, I found at the end of Volume 2, was building up to the divorce to Josephine. What he has to psych himself up to do to carry that through is gut-wrenching. He's had an assassination attempt, more to the point, he's been so ill, he's actually admitted it to Josephine and his mum. He doesn't do that. And when then after he divorces her, you know, she goes to live in, live in Malmaison, he goes to live in the Trianon, the Petit Trianon in Versailles. And he's writing her letters every couple of hours. It's like he's texting somebody. You break up with somebody and you never text them, and then suddenly you start to text them. And that's what it was like. And that's when you really get, I think, close to the guy. And it's not often what you think.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I was going to, you know, if you're the spirit of the age, which is the title of your second volume, then you're almost inhuman, but you're bestriding the world like a colossus, or at least you're embodying it.
But that's what somebody called him, remember. That's what Hegel called him. It's not to say Hegel was right. It's like Soldier of Destiny. People wonder where that came from. When they got Josephine and Napoleon had their excuse for a wedding, on the way, he picks up this trinket somewhere of a stall, and it's not gold, it's an old gold sort of thing, medallion, and inscribed, real bling, but inscribed across it is the word destiny, and he gives it to her, destiny. And to me, again, it was gut-wrenching, because it was, but what kind of destiny? But that's why he's the Soldier of Destiny. It's also the name of an Irish political party translated into English. and I think there's only one person who ever got that. But he sadly died before the book was published. But it came out. But that's why they have those names. that I wanted to call Volume 3 The Famous Delinquent, because that's what Chateaubriand calls him. But the publisher thought, yeah, I'm sorry, Michael. No, you know, come on now, we're friends. But, you know, come on, mate, come on. But because Chateaubriand says in 1818, you know, well, we finally heard the last of The Famous Delinquent. And, of course, a few weeks later, the first set of memoirs from St. Helena hit the streets.
There we go. Very good. So what have you gone with then? What is Volume 3 going to be called?
It's called Rise and Fall of an Empire.
Okay. And what's the rationale behind that? Because, you know, 1810 to 1815, hasn't the empire already risen by then?
Well, the empire is at its peak in 1811, you could argue, in many ways. Gibbon haunts the pages, really. I was bitten by a gibbon at a very impressionable age. You know, I fell in love with Gibbon as a schoolboy, because I did classics a lot when I was at school. You know, this is the background to it, and there was this aspect of it that you don't get from just doing, you know, the Tacitus and Livy. But the way Gibbon says it, really, the rot starts with Augustus. And I remember reading that as a 15-year-old and thinking, you are, but you go on, 1811. It's all there, and yet it's not. Mistakes have been made, there's overstretch, and yet for a while it seems to work, you know, and then, so this decline, this implosion, where does this come from? I would never purport to have the answer, but, you know, there are all sorts of factors in play that lead to an implosion that you wouldn't have bet on in 1811. But that you would probably, but that some people were betting on in 1811 when he starts to talk about Russia, and that's where it comes from. But it comes from Gibbon.
What I'm struck by talking to you is the fallibility and very human nature of Napoleon Bonaparte, someone who's, as you pointed out, you know, is often uncertain even in moments when he's perceived as being hubristic, and doesn't that lend itself towards the notion of the fundamental instability of what he was trying to achieve and construct? Are you dignifying what he constructed by calling it, you know, imperial or an empire? I mean, it was what it was, but for a very short period of time.
Brodel was a big influence on me, and I think you have to think on different levels. In terms of his redrawing the map of Europe, in terms of, which is not quite as daft as it seems with further west you go. Again, it's a mixed bag. Certainly in terms of his military hubris, that's where you see it, the hubris. On the military side, you see it at Waterloo, you see it to a certain extent in Russia. You know, one big battle, come on boys, we can do it. But where you see, and yes, that's going to collapse. You can see that France just can't take it. His empire can't take it. Although even there, I would have a caveat. Gumpatin Zeman, Metternich's incredibly shrewd diplomacy that get pulled literally after Leipzig, pulls the rug out, literally pulls the territory out from under him, the loss of the German princes. That's the end. Anything else could have been. You watch the negotiations. I'm very impressed by, say, the way Monroe Price dealt with a lot of these negotiations in his book. But, well, you know, I will do deals. I will pull back. But it's too late. Now, all of that is fragile. It's probably, I mean, there is a great deal in what Paul Schroeder says that too many times to make a war in his own empire because of the war machine. But when you look at the reforms that he put in place over most of Western Europe, it's still there. You know, you look at the code, the administrative system, the educational system. It's still there. When you look at it as an Anglo-Saxon, all right, I'm not Anglo-Saxon, I'm Irish, but, you know, but when you look at it from the outside, you see how important the similarities are rather than the differences in Europe, why they can all work together, why the system just, and they endure. And where they don't, where they're showing, they try to do away with them, you know, in certain places. I mean, my own people, where I did my own research, you know, they have a go at that, they have a go in Spain, it comes back, because this is how you do it. It's, you find the solidity of the empire, not in the empire, but in the individual states who can adapt the Napoleonic reforms, just top and tail them, not a lot of change, and they're still there, you know, and that's why their judicial systems, their administrative systems can work together so easily when they're allowed to, You get the AIDS epidemic, you get the COVID epidemic on the Rhineland. Baden and Alsace-Lorraine just do it. Why? Because their administrative systems are basically similar. Their governments operate in a similar way. Why can you extradite people within EU countries, you know, so easily? Because the judicial systems are the same. Ours isn't. You know, and that endures. And he knew that.
He knew that, yeah. Well, one of the great joys and also frustrations, I think, of, you know, being a historian of any kind is that when you, the more you look into something, the more questions are raised. So I wanted to ask what are the unanswered questions that maybe hadn't occurred to you before you started on this decade of work that now sort of, you know, hang over you as you think about your subject that you've spent such a long time examining? What are the big ambiguities or the unresolved question marks about Napoleon Bonaparte?
You can never really know another human being, you know, not if you haven't met them. I think every biographer has to own up to that. You can't know what everybody was thinking every minute of the day and what their feelings were. You can try to get inside their heads. I've tried it my way. Other people have tried it other ways. I think one of the biggest single one for a jobbing historian like me would be this. Napoleon did not surround himself with yes men.
Ah.
He did not.
And that says a lot about someone.
Cambaceres, Caulaincourt, Mondrian, you know, his financial, where's his accountant, basically, his main Berthier Davout, they were not yes men. His brothers were not yes men. The portrait you come away is often, the Council of State was not fully yes men. The younger ones could be intimidated, but not even so much by him, more by Cambaceres. But he would let truth be spoken to him. And he would not punish people who did that. The only time he sort of seated it was when he dumped Champigny and brings in Marat as foreign minister, but there are two reasons for that. Champigny's Talleyrand's creature.
Right.
And on the other hand, Marat has come out with the line, but he says it himself very outspokenly, when it was not the thing to say, when Talleyrand was still in the saddle, I support the Duchy of Warsaw. I think that's more important than offending Alexander. And when Napoleon comes to that mind, he brings in Marat in, but not because Marat will do exactly what he wants, but because Marat thinks like him. He does not have yes men around him. And they'll all tell you that, you know, but he sat down, had it out with him. He listened to me. He made notes. Well, think about it. But he still didn't follow my advice. And the great mystery is, like, you've been bombarded by it. You know, Cambaceres more gently, Caulaincourt diplomatically, other people hammering it into him. Russia's a bad idea, boss. You know, maybe it is. But well, I can't see another way through it. That's the mystery, that, you know, you let truth be spoken to you, but somehow or other, no, I'm sticking to my guns. I think that's the big mystery. Because in so many ways, I think the other thing is the grandeur, which is not really like it. You know, the big egotism, the palaces, the robes. He's not like that as a person. He's not. That's a bit of a mystery. Is there a public sphere and a private sphere?
Okay, yeah. Well, that central ambiguity that persists, and I can see how, yeah, you know, that continues to be a head scratcher, and one which I think probably comes to the fore in this, your final book of this series, this trilogy.
Yes, it is. You can see it beforehand. You know, you can see it. One of the things that, again, that I look for the process in it, that he's always authoritarian, say, with his siblings. You could not be. I mean, he's, you know, if you're sane, that's how you have to treat these guys. But he is authoritarian, very. But for so long, even towards the very end, he can be tempered by people around him. No, it's not a good idea to abolish the Chamber of Deputies, the Court of Legislative. It's not a good idea. Okay, I won't do it. You know, he can listen to that, and yet there's so many other things that he has his prejudices. they are not unfounded, but they influence him at strange times.
Well, Michael, my son's, I mentioned my son's drumming lesson is going to interrupt us, and that's now imminent. I'm not sure whether he'll be practicing the Paths of Charge today.
I was wondering that.
Yes. But I just wanted to say thank you so much for speaking to me. And I think this is going to be an interview that listeners to this podcast will absolutely love hearing and have really enjoyed. It's great to speak to you, and your new book is I'll leave it to the version of myself that's about to pop up and say, tell you exactly what's going on, but for now, Michael, thank you so much. It's been brilliant.
My pleasure, Alex. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, well, there we are. Thank you to my past self, as well as, of course, to Michael Brez. And Napoleon, The Decline and Fall of an Empire, 1811 to 1821. It was published on August the 2nd, 2022. It's 735 pages in a hardcover, which is fairly eye-watering. But let's say that's good value for money. Join me in a couple of weeks' time. I'm going to be introducing, as I say, the next phase for the Napoleonic Quarterly, as it moves on from its first quarter, the first 6 years of history covered off, just 18 more to go, yikes. But bye for now.